The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Of Thought Crime Radio. I'm your host, Rich, and my co-host is on the line, I believe, from Eugene, Oregon, the hypnotherapist extraordinaire, Patricia. Is she there? Patricia, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right, then. So,
great.
Today we're going to talk about another way in which we as a society and a country and a world have been fooled again by the powers that be. And on the line, we have Guido Preparata. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Guido, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Is it Guido or Guido? Or?
Yeah, it's Guido, yes.
Guido, okay. So he he studied economics in Rome, Stanford, and the London School of Economics. He got an MA in economics and a PhD in political economy from the University of Southern California. Did additional doctoral coursework at UCLA, mathematics and economic history, and Caltech economic history. He was a research analyst at the Bank of Italy, and then was associate professor of political economy at the University of Washington until 2008, and a Fulbright scholar to the Middle East in 2005. He now specializes in criminology at the University of Cambridge in Great Britain. And he wrote a book which I think ties directly into our current situation in this country and in the world, in relation to the mass looting of the subjugation of the nations of the world under the scam of the money changers. The book is called Conjuring Hitler, and so Guido, you have a totally different take on the history of World War II. You say that we've been fed a huge lie, I guess the big lie, with regard to this being the good war with the United States and Britain riding in on white horses and saving the day from the evil Germans. You say that things are quite a bit more complicated than that. Can you, first of all, can you go into how you ran across this material? What I assume you were doing research in connection with your what, dissertation?
I can barely hear you, but it started when I was at the Bank of Italy, and I was studying in my spare time Nazi finance. And then one thing led to another, and then when I went back to finishing my doctoral studies in California, and I chose that as the dissertation topic. So that's how the thing got started, and so the book was the product of roughly a decade of study, and then the class I taught at the University of Washington helped me develop a number of these things, because I went in all sorts of directions surrounding that topic, and so the end product was the book.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of source materials did you rely on?
Well, for the most part, in secondary literature, I've tried to read as much as I can. I mean, the literature is enormous, so I've read several languages, everything. I mean, most of the things that are available out there, diplomatic history, politics, politics history, economics, financial history of the Weimar era, I mean, everything, religious views of the Nazis, and so on and so forth. As far as primary documentation, I dug several thousands of documents from the archives of the Bank of England, and I quote that to a certain extent, but generally archival search tends to be a frustrating endeavor, because the juicy stuff is never disclosed, so you get to read all stuff that's been mined already, and for the most part irrelevant. So the thing is that even without having any kind of access to some magic information, pieces of the puzzle are out there, and one just needs to draw a line and just connect the dots, and another picture emerges, so to speak.
Of course, it helps if someone reads several languages and goes to many different countries and does that research, which most of us don't do, so I really appreciate that you have done that.
I guess people who are in the field will tell you that they just everybody does that, and I've been accused of having done something that's not profound enough, because when you maintain a thesis that is so controversial, they expect you to have some kind of incredible document that nobody's seen before, and I just argue that there's no need for that deep down, because just as I said, the pieces are there. So.
Mm-hmm.
So assembling the pieces was fairly straightforward once you.
I'm sorry, Rich. You'll have to speak up, because I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry. Assembling the pieces was the most painstaking part of this, and seeing the overall picture once you had the pieces together was not all that difficult.
I missed the last part of the question. As I said, the volume is really low. I apologize, but I can barely hear you.
I'm not sure that I have any control over that volume. I'll try to speak up here.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to assemble all this material?
Roughly a decade, yeah.
Wow, okay. So,
The study began in the mid-90s when I was at the Central Bank, and the book came out in 05. So, I mean, I did a bunch of other things in between, but yeah, I mean, this has been my main focus for all that time, yeah.
So you went into the motivations of the Anglo-American strategic planners that occupied their attention in the decades prior to World War II. Could you go into some of that information about what sort of issues were Britain and
sure.
the United
well,
States.
Well, I guess the problem was a very simple one. I, like everybody else, I heard the story as everybody else did, and it's a question of point of attack. I mean, we always see these movies and so on and so forth, where you see these Nazis, these awesome Nazis with the perfectly cut uniforms that come into the scene and start to do all sorts of atrocious things, and it makes for good cinema, but I always ask myself, how did this disaster come about. And I just want to understand what went on before. How could this phenomenon, that this monster could be in gestation for so long and nobody noticing and so on. And I just decided to go and dig in the initial part of the story, which doesn't make for good cinema because it's full of financial intricacies and all sorts of things that have not been portrayed in film. And the more you look into this and you realize that the story was quite different. The thesis is simple. I mean, the United States have just taken on what used to be the old imperial drive of the British Commonwealth, which is these countries, the America and Britain, are not continental countries; they are islands, and they think like maritime empires. For them, it's a question of the world is a stage for conquest. And this is how the world is conceived, as power struggle, and it's us versus them, and these maritime empires, imperial powers, are consolidate their empire initially through the Navy and now through air power, and their main concern is the mainland, what they call the Eurasian landmass. It's this huge stretch of physical land that goes from France to China, which is this one block of land, and for islands, it's problematic to face this thing because if they want to conquer this thing, they have to split it, and they have to make sure it's perennially divided so they can control it. And so the British Empire did this extraordinary skill, which in fact impressed Hitler tremendously. He had a great admiration for what they did with very few people and a fleet that could control India and the seas. And so this was the game. So what happened towards the end of the 18th century was this thing that was not really predicted, was the emergence of this German power that was not there before. And so there was this fear of seeing this new actor coming in full force and full strength at the heart of this Eurasian landmass. And you could sense while you read the literature in those days and you know the discipline of geopolitics that was being assembled in those days that the British strategists began to be twitchy and antsy about this, because if this tremendous potential that was behind Germany came into full bloom, and not only that, and it started to spread and make an alliance, worse still, with the former Russian Empire, then this could cause not just a problem, this was really the end of any kind of long-term imperial aims on the part of Britain. And this, we are now at the gates of World War One. So World War One is the decisive moment in our recent history where the British are just recognizing that their glory is fading, but the American power is there, and they can look at the American power as a kindred spiritual heirs to this, and they keep the strategic planning of this game, but they pass on the military logistical aspect to America, and they're going to begin to lay siege to Germany in World War One. And Germany was this green power, fairly obnoxious and young, and preventing from this eventual alliance at the heart of the landmass from consolidating. And everything follows from that.
So this
when
was...
you propose these things in a class setting or to people who are not used to this type of vision, it generally irks and disturbs folk because they're used to thinking that the Germans are the worst people on earth and they've always been the bad guys way before Hitler. And so to start seeing things as if, well, we're the initiators of this, is just not acceptable. But that's exactly how it went, unfortunately, for those who have these kinds of feelings.
So the strategic aim here was to keep the European landmass and the Asian landmass politically isolated from each other.
Split, by inserting what they called wedges in the jargon of early geopolitical British thinkers. And if you look at today, the game is always the same. The way the American bases are spread all over the world, they are Right now they're doing an encirclement of China, but and look at where the battles have been fought, in the Balkans, down to Israel, and then in Georgia. It's always the same tactics, and it's in all the books of the important counselors of the national security bodies, such people like Brzezinski and so on and so forth, people who just taught Secretary of State, such as Madeleine Albright, or Kissinger. They always say the same thing.
So
our number one objective is to prevent any kind of political formations, the nationalistic formations on the European landmass, anything that could just prevent us from controlling this stretch of land.
So you're saying
and
that...
And so they've been playing this game for 100 years.
Yes.
It's always the same one.
So you're saying
the means change. And then first you have the wars, conventional wars. Then you have the Cold War, which was a different setup. Now they use terrorism, but it's always the same game.
So you're saying that the Yugoslav wars were a continuation of this as well?
Absolutely, yes. It's always the same problem. These are zones of fracture.
Yep.
And it's along these particular fault lines, as they're called, that the maritime empires, and in this case the Anglo-American Commonwealth, needs to act and put these wedges to prevent there to be any kind of entente forming in the European, the Eurasian, in the Eurasian setup. In this case, of course, there Serbia was, that's a very critical zone because it's at the gates of the East. There's the connection with Russia. Past that, there's Eastern Europe and Turkey and so on and so forth. So these are critical zones where there needs to be constant patrolling, and NATO does precisely this. I mean, it enlarges. It goes by waves of enlargement, attracting more and more satellites in order to carve into that kind of area. These things have been explained in very plain terms in books such as The Grand Chessboard by Brzezinski and others.
Yeah, Brzezinski
is
very...
the strategy of the U.S.
Brzezinski is very straightforward in that book, talking about, conquest and keeping the...
But that's what it's about.
Yes.
I mean, this is a game about conquest. All these wars are wars of position.
Yeah.
Afghanistan, you know, why are the troops are in Afghanistan? Afghanistan is at the center of the world. China on the one hand, Russia to the north, Iran, the Middle East. On the one hand, on the one side, then on the south, you have the Indian Peninsula. I mean, it's position, it's empire. That's all it is. And that's all there is.
So, in the decades leading up to World War II, how did these fascist thinkers, these strategic thinkers in the American and British hierarchies, how did they try to address their concerns with the world conquest?
Before World War II?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, before World War II, when Germany was the crux of the problem, in that sense, Germany is portrayed, and the rise of Nazism is portrayed as this really an awesome and unique and moment, but it really isn't. In a sense, it's a continuation of World War I. World War I, as I said, has been described by this as a siege, and the expression is not mine, but I think it portrays exactly what it was. Was a siege against Germany, and it succeeded, but not quite, because the aim was not to defeat the Germans. The aim was to destroy Germany altogether. And so the Germans, in November of 18, they just surrendered. They couldn't just fight single-handedly everybody, and so they surrendered. From that point on, it's been the story that's told in the book. It's been a very long strategic process of making sure that the job could be finished, and so this is to be viewed as a tremendously conspiratorial vision of the events. So we have roughly 25 years between one war and 20 years between one war and another. So, but there is this, and I cited in the book this extraordinary prophecy by one of America's great thinkers, probably the greatest social scientist of all times. That is Thorsten Veblen, who in one of his reviews of these books that were being published at the time about the reparations and all the things that were being imposed on defeated Germany, just wrote that the common publicist have not understood what's happening. What is being done here is just a procrastination of a war that is yet to come, of turning, of not harming, we give the impression that we're harming Germany by asking for all these sanctions, but we really aren't. We are radicalizing the masses, and we're making them ready for a new military regime. And I mean, he saw Nazism coming, and there's even a portrait of Hitler that he draws in a really uncanny way in 1915, another book of a future megalomaniac, rabble-rousing leader of Germany. This is just the beauty of Bedlin, and unique. These things have never been, to my knowledge, never been mentioned by any scholar before, and we're talking about Bedlin, not a nobody. And he says, and while we've done this, we've radicalized the masses, so we've angered the masses, but we have not touched the absentees, the ones who really rule the country, by not sequestering their financial wealth. And Bedlin saw that as the clue. He says they are just waiting for a comeback of a militarized reactionary regime, which they can then meaning the Anglo-Saxon planners at Versailles, at the time of the peace treaty, to thrust him against Bolshevik Russia. So he anticipated Operation Barbarossa, that when the Germans invaded, the Nazis invaded the Bolsheviks in June of 41, he anticipated by 20 years, because he wrote this in 1920. So somebody already saw this war coming and understood exactly what was happening. So on the basis of this phenomenal document, it's a three-page review article, unnoticed, unmentioned, of one of the greatest geniuses in the social sciences, I have just built my own book, and I show that it was so indeed. They have been waiting to bring him up so that Hitler and his movement, although it's impossible to say whether they could expect something like that, something so vibrantly religious as Nazism, because Nazism was a religious movement and a fairly disturbing one. Nobody knew. It's hard to say if anybody could tell, but surely they knew that a military regime was coming back, and that's exactly what they were engineering. Why? Not because they wanted it, but because it would have provided the perfect opportunity to destroy Germany once and for all, which is what they did. They bombed it to the ground.
So you're saying that they arranged for the ascension of the Nazis in Germany through decades of economic sanctions?
Manipulation. Well, this is. I don't say it. Bedlin cast this prophecy in September of 1920.
But you were able to corroborate this with declassified documents from the Bank of England and other documents?
The Bank of England reveals nothing. There are no documents saying, the governor of the Bank of England will do this in order to raise Germany to the ground. But we've seen there's no need to see this. We will never see such documents, even if they exist. All you need to do is to look at what they did. And if you look at the policies of the British vis-à-vis Hitler and what the Bank of England did to help Germany to rearm, this is a country which is extremely industrious and so on, but very poor in raw resources except for coal and potash. So it needed tremendous amount of materials to refurbish itself, which were provided by the British Empire through the offices of the Bank of England. And that is documented. Everybody knows this. And if you add everything up, you'll see that there is a design. The period of appeasement, well, they say that the British cabinets were not too sure about what to do with Hitler. They knew he was a raving madman and somebody absolutely not to be trusted, but they wanted peace. And all of that is absolutely not true. At those levels, they know exactly what they're doing. They're not stupider than the average population. They're far more intelligent. And there was a design of treating this strange phenomenon, which was heading, in any case, which was fronting a phenomenon which had been foreseen already in 1920. So they knew exactly what they were doing.
So you're basically describing a transnational cabal of American and British financial interests operating through the Bank of England?
I wouldn't put it in transnational cabal, because these terms could be seen as in a pejorative sense as these are just strategists, imperial strategists that
right.
use any means necessary to achieve their aims. This is what they do. This is empire. This is imperium. This is how it's done. But you know, this thing cost tens of millions. Well, and how many people were killed in Iraq? According to the most conservative estimates of this last war, 150,000 people. Do these people care? Do these rulers, do these strategists have ever cared? No, of course not.
No.
The game is much more than all of these concerns. Millions of deaths, of dead, details.
Makes you feel like a chess piece. Just a little on a big board.
It does.
Did you run across any evidence of specific aid, aside from radicalizing the population and arming Germany after the Nazis took power? Did you run across any evidence of direct political support or financial support for the Nazis?
Yes. Well, there's that very famous shred of documentation found, and they discussed it. It came out, and the Guardian made this flashing article about it. And we all remember about the grandfather of George Bush, Prescott, the Senator Prescott Bush, who was not him. He was just a director or a mid-level director in one of the banks of the group of Harriman, they found some money that was been transferred from the States to accounts reserved for the Nazis by way of a Dutch corporation. It was found through a Senate investigation under the Trading with the Enemy Act, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember this article correctly, and nobody has challenged this piece of information. Just a smoking gun. I mean, there's that, and so I remember people trying to build theories upon it, saying, oh, well, the Bushes, there's a dynasty, so they have some kind of spiritual affinity towards other fascists. Complete nonsense. I mean, there's no affinity whatsoever. These are very, very different spiritual animals. These were just strategic moves that were done to fatten up this regime in order to destroy it later.
So you're saying the financial class was directing the political class? I guess that's not surprising, but
no, I don't believe that.
Oh.
I don't believe that. I think it doesn't go that way. It's never gone that way. And corporations originally were born as at the time of the Crusades. They were just joint stock companies were organized by merchants to accompany the crusading expeditions, and it's always been like that. Corporations and the banking interests are tremendously important and tremendously powerful, but they don't have any kind of strategic directive decision-making power they follow. So there is political will first, and then there is financial assistance. And so it's not that we are just being duped and ruled by bankers. It's the bankers are part of a very precise strategic design. It's a political feat above all.
So once Hitler took power, to what degree...
Who, Hitler?
Hitler, yes.
Uh-huh.
Once he took power, to what degree was he reliant on Western financial aid to build up his military?
Well, we don't know the exact amount of credits that were extended to him by the Bank of England. We know that there were such things and that they have been hushed. They were there. The amount, percentage-wise, I don't know. The help was there, and the rearmament was there, and the as I said, raw resources were provided, and there's also been a few important studies that have not been challenged in their qualitative kernel of truth, that a lot of patents and technical know-how has been provided also by way of America, and then also there's a certain movement of what is one scholar in particular talks about American corporate responsibility in helping the Nazis and also in the Holocaust. And so there's IBM, General Motors, Ford, and all these people provided material industrial infrastructure to the Nazis, certainly up until the beginning of the war. But not just another thing that everybody tells is that the Soviets too, up until the day before the Nazis invaded Belarus, Stalin has been appeasing the Nazis too, and that makes you think. Well, people say, well, that's because he just wanted to deflect Hitler versus his Western opponent. But that's not the case. This was one organized maneuver, coordinated through the British with the Soviets to, as I said, empower for a while this regime and then crush it. And that's the victory which the Russians ultimately, upon their flesh, have carried. So there's all these things, and then of course the loans and so on and so forth. And then there were also a number of financial transactions being affected even throughout the war in Switzerland, where there was at the Bank of the International Settlements, which was created in 1930. Apparently, there were these seances where the central bankers of the respective the belligerents. And so the Germans sitting next to the British and so on and so forth were still sharing profits and so on and so forth. And when I requested to see some of these documents at the Bank of England, they refused because they're not open to the public. And this 60 years after the fact, what is there to hide, right? Well, apparently there is still a lot to hide. And so
you're saying there's so many
things that just don't add up. And yeah. I just tried to play with a number of them.
I mean, I'm having a hard time here understanding in which way the power flows. Is it flowing from the central banks to the respective governments, or are the central banks reflecting some kind of consensus among the political hierarchies of...
I think so, sure. The central banks don't take the initiative. Well, who really knows? But, I mean, and from what I studied... No. It's the political establishment that wages these battles. The economic sector, even though it's of extraordinary importance, is an auxiliary.
But these central banks are not owned by their respective governments, right? They're owned by transnational financial interests, isn't that? At least some of them.
Well, right now they are, but it depends. I mean, one would have to see exactly what is the stock ownership of each bank, and then a number of them have been nationalized after the war, but it doesn't matter. And besides, the central bank is has a very important role. Although, when we think of the money that circulates, it's not the central bank. I mean, the true flows of money are going to the private banking sector, which is the real economic force and when monetary strength is being considered. And central banks at the time were clearly important coordinating centers of a variety of things, including imperial policy. But they were following orders. This extraordinary character who's been in charge of the Bank of England for a generation, this Montague Norman, one of the most fascinating, extraordinary characters of the 20th century, of which nothing is known virtually. It wasn't his idea to befriend and cajole the governor of the Reichsbank and to give money to the Nazis. He didn't do it out of some kind of anti-Semitic fancy, as others say. He was following orders and implementing them with a savvy and a mastery that was extraordinary and beyond the capabilities of many others. But he was still following orders. He was just following the dictates of what the imperial circles had decided. And he was just implementing these things. And in fact, there's that scene that I briefly recall in my book where Winston Churchill, just in 1933, just raises a glass to the British banking system at the time when it was thought that the British banking system had completely failed. So this is what they said to the public. Well, there's been the suspension of gold payments. There was a million people unemployed and so on and so forth, and yet Churchill raised a glass to them and praising what a phenomenal job they have done. So what does that mean? It means that they were just following precise precise instructions and beautifully achieved from their viewpoint.
This is extraordinary claims being made here. I mean, the amount of secrecy over many generations, the long-term outlook of the planners is phenomenal.
I know. One of the critiques, eventually, that one could raise against the book, saying, well, you know, how could you possibly maintain something so outlandish that these stewards of the empire could just wait 20 years? And yet they do. There's so many instances. Their allegiance is to a notion of empire and to their... these are patriots. They really believe in it. And generation after generation, they just do the same work, and some die along the way and are replaced. And
are they patriots, or are they just psychopaths?
That's what it was. And then again, the prophecy of Thorsten Veblen is there. That, you know, just wait. He says, wait. They're going to come back. And he uses these terms. I mean, he uses radicalization, which is exactly what the Nazis, what the Goebbels will talk about when he's going to go for it, when he's going to go and grab the votes in the working class districts of Berlin. Radikalisierung. It's the exact same terms that Veblen uses in this prophecy. Just wait. He says, it's going to happen. And it took 20 years. And
so are these prophecies or are they plans? Are they blueprints?
Sorry?
Are they prophecies or are they blueprints that guide?
Well, Veblen, as you know, was a social scientist and someone who took his scholarship very seriously. I use the word prophecy, which is, of course, might be interpreted as some kind of a mystical misnomer, but this is the work of a scientific genius. This is why we read geniuses, because they are so good at what they do that they can tell you what's going to happen on the base of analysis. That's what he's done. Blueprint. Sure, you can read that as a blueprint. He's a very interesting character. He's a utopian. He's somebody who wanted to see a different America. He was somebody who wanted to see communes of peaceful engineers and living in peace and so on and so forth, and nothing came to pass. And so there come these brooding ruminations about the state of the world, and you could just feel the pessimism and the bitterness. And yet he remains lucid throughout this and sees far ahead.
I need to do a station break. We're having a fun drive here at this community radio station, and if people want to hear unpopular historical perspectives like this one, please support this station.
Okay, I have an idea for You Care, You Share October fun drive spot.
What is it?
There's nothing really to it.
What do we do?
Just read this.
You Care, You Share.
No, read the whole thing.
Okay, KOPN is holding their fall fun drive on Monday, October 18th through Sunday, October 24th. Please tune in and contribute to show that you care, you share, in support for our great programming and independent media.
That's it?
That's the whole spot?
Yep.
You are completely devoid of creativity.
I know. It's a gift.
This program brought to you by listener support and a donation from Smokin' Chicks Barbecue. Smokin' Chicks Barbecue serves up a fresh and flavorful selection of meats, sides, desserts, and specialty items. They can cater your tailgate or holiday party, or you can visit them at their restaurant at 4603 John Gary Drive in Columbia. More information available at smokinchicksbbq.com or at 256-6450. Smokin' Chicks Barbecue, mouth-watering, finger-licking barbecue.
So, Guido, could you get into a little more detail about the Western support, financial support, and whatever political manipulations might have been operating in Germany during the time of the Nazis?
Well, manipulations. As soon as the Nazis seized power, the Bank of England vouched for sales of bonds, so they helped place their stock, their stock and debentures for people to buy. So they conveyed money to them. And that's for the international support and whatever other credits there were. And plus there is a story of all sorts of tricks and Swiss techniques that were devised by this other charismatic person, the head of the central bank in Germany under Hitler, who was there even before Hitler took power. And so that in itself is also a case study in financial history to see what was done to make the recovery so swift. Because in less than 4 years, Hitler erases unemployment, so much so that they have labor shortages. So by 1938, he's at the pinnacle of his glory, and he's hailed as some kind of a messiah because Germany was a shambles before when he came, I mean, in the early 30s, and then after that. And so it's a story of this. So there is tremendous, there's this hidden hand of foreign help, coming from Russia and America and Britain, and then there's also a lot of prowess and virtuosity, financial virtuosity, performed by the Reichsbank and the economic teams of Germany at the time. So the two combined together made Germany grow at the same pace. And so there's also part of the literature that says, well, the strength of Hitler's army has been exaggerated. It was a ramshackle army that appears strong, but it wasn't. But I don't think so. I think the damages that army inflicted was before everybody's eyes. So it was an impressive feat.
You're saying that the economic catastrophe of the Weimar Republic was also brought on by these external agents?
Yes, well, that I have no doubt. I devote what I think is the most important chapter of the book, and the fourth one, to telling the story of how this tremendous slump hit the world, and Germany especially, in 31, 32. Where the Nazis and there was these 4 years, the binge years, from 24 to 28, very strange period. And then the Nazis obviously disappear. They, at the 1928 elections, they garner not even 3% of the vote. And then all of a sudden, the payments and the money that was pouring in from Wall Street and so on comes to an abrupt end in mysterious ways. We know there's Black Friday and so on and so forth. And Germany, who was just living on artificial transfusion of money, is suddenly paralyzed. And lo and behold, the Nazis come back and garner 30% of the vote and become the second party in Germany. And so, the mechanics of election trajectories could not be more blatant. This is how it's done.
So what you're describing is an early instance of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine as applied to Germany.
I don't know. I don't exactly know what she's. Well, her view, I think, is more that they create these earthquakes and then they exploit. So it's more of an economistic way of looking at disruption. I don't see things this way. For me, there is a political project first of all, and then a variety of course, economic tools that are key. In fact, they used the embargo too, when the Germans didn't want to surrender, and they used this really cruel embargo. They killed a lot of children and civilians and animals and farm animals, hundreds of thousands. And when they were starved, they finally signed the peace treaty. I mean, this is how they operate. So, financial techniques is one of the many arrows that they use. For sure.
So, Guido, are you concerned that this might happen again?
Well, again, it is happening, is it not? I don't know. I don't know about Hitler or a phenomenon like Nazism. That one was really strange, as I said, because because it brought back not only a reactionary regime that was brutal, but because they had these very strange Gnostic conception of the world, and hence this notion of the threat from the Jewish people, which has yet to be explained from their viewpoint, what they were really thinking. So that was a very peculiar incident. But in terms of forthcoming wars and so on and so forth, well, yes, I mean, as I said before, what do we think all these maneuvers that are happening in the world and this deployment of American troops all over the place mean? They're not out there looking for resources or precious ore under the crust of the mountains of Afghanistan or wherever. They're there to... They're encircling China, that's for sure, and they're keeping an eye on Russia. And then in the U.S. spends at least, what is it, I read, $700 billion in weapons alone, and this is official data, not to mention the budget of defense and all the hundreds of thousands of men and arms they have all over the world. And what for? What for? To defend themselves from bearded mullahs with Kalashnikovs? I don't think so.
No, obviously. No,
they are pursuing. They're not done yet. They're continuing.
Oh, yes, right. Actually, I was reading something yesterday about it led into the mafia. And then I read this letter from someone named Albert Pike to Mazzini, who put the M in mafia. And he wrote this letter, and he said, "The First World War must be brought about in order to permit us to overthrow the power of the czars in Russia," and so on. "The Second World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences between the fascists," and so on. "The Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the different..." I think the differences... Okay, there are two things here. One is that there is a plan for three world wars. The other is that it focuses on differences, which is what you're saying. You drive a wedge between people. You divide and conquer. And so that's apparently what they're doing. This letter that I was reading from is on threeworldwars.com and /Albert-Pike. But I think that there's a very big plan, and it does not care about people, and it does not care about life on planet Earth. It does care about conquest. I think that you have it nailed, and there are very huge powers that are involved in this, and I think that whatever research you did, you know, it was invaluable to point out how this whole phenomenon works, that war doesn't just happen accidentally. It's not just just somebody's whim that, oh, I think we'll just hold a war. There really is purpose behind it, and the excuses that were given. There's a man named Eddie Bernays who actually helped engineer these wars by turning public opinion toward, you know, in the favor of going to war. And so the public relations industry is, you know, key to the success of such maneuvers. And, you know, you can see it on television and even hear it on radio, except for good programs like ours, which are turning the opposite direction. But, you know, there's a huge force that wants to go in the direction of destruction. And it's going to take us becoming educated and wising up and really turning our entire intention in the opposite direction, because you don't fight against wars. You know, you have to do something different. You have to actually address the core issue, and you have located it, that there are governments and financial institutions and corporations whose very existence depends on war, and whose purpose is to conquer as much of the planet as they possibly can. So we really need to go to the source of that and stop the people who are doing the organization and the planning of all these wars, you know.
I was interested.
I totally agree with you, but it's we've seen after 9/11 how hard it's been, because they're very good at this. And generally, a lesson they've learned from World War I is never appear as the aggressors. Mm-hmm. They always things mm-hmm. are always done in such a way that there's always a threat, an external threat, and then they go right. wherever they to fight this evil, and this confuses right. people.
We want to be the victim. We are the victim, so then we have to protect ourselves.
Right.
But even without going, sure, even without going to speculating too hard about anything, yeah, I think we could do a lot more in protesting against the slaughter and simply that. But oddly enough, the West, not just the U.S., but Europe too, I noticed, it just doesn't mm-hmm. care. I mean, people just, you know, you talk about these extraordinary
yeah.
death tolls.
Well, I think the people are anesthetized. I think they're in a stupor. They've been hypnotized by television and by yeah. campaign slogans, and you know their minds are not alert and aware, and they don't have the capabilities of doing all this research in all these different places and all these different languages, and then actually synthesizing it and putting it all together. So we're very reliant on people who do those kind of things, and that's what you do. That's what you did, and your book is invaluable.
Do you, Guido?
I just hope to see a peace movement, a real one, come back.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
Guido, do you have an estimate for what percent of the German war budget and armaments industries was financed by Western interests, non-German interests?
No, I don't think I have that figure. I can't say to what extent they, financially speaking, they contributed, but they were essential. Without them, Hitler would have gone nowhere. In every sense, in terms of resources, not let alone how they let him progress from the you know, because Germany had all these demilitarized zones and so on and so forth, and they let him go from the Rhine to Austria and then to Czechoslovakia. They let him do it in every sense. But the number, I don't know, and I wouldn't even venture a percentage.
What was the mechanism by which they brought about this hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic?
In 1923?
Yeah.
Well, that's also one of the several puzzles. I have ventured my own idea of the thing was, it was related to the thing Veblen saw. I mean, that there were still all these financial claims that were still standing and that had not been sequestered, and there was this huge war debt that too should have been still in the hands of the absentee owners of Germany, of the rich, of the wealthy, the powerful of Germany. That too should have been sequestered, and it wasn't. And so I think that as I tell in the third chapter, that triggered some kind of a purging dynamic, that people got rid of these things fast, and that coupled with a variety of other factors triggered this massive meltdown, which was great because it cleared the way for recreating that first influx of capital to Germany. That's when the rearmament of Germany begins way before Hitler. It starts in 24, in the golden year, so to speak, when Wall Street sends these millions of dollars to refurbish and renew and modernize Germany. When Hitler takes power, the infrastructure he takes was not old. It was a brand new car that had been lying dormant for a while, and so these things happened. They were possible after Germany had been cleared of its old currency through this process. Again, people would say, was that accidental or not? I don't think it was, precisely because Veblen identified this point. Says, look, this is dangerous because these people have lost the war and they have still this huge war debt, and nobody's doing anything about it. And those who hold this debt are going to get rid of it, and this is going to cause problems. He didn't explain how, but then we saw what it meant. And so 5 years after the war, this happens, and after this, the currency goes to nothing. They issue a new currency, anchored to gold, according to a very strict ratios, and slowly the money comes, and it's like an artificial experiment. In other words, the money is imported, and Germany is built from the outside in this strange stupor that Germany lives for these 4 years, in which the Nazis vanished completely from the political scene. Then Germany is modernized, that was phase number one, and then all of a sudden it stops. There are 3 years of agony, and then the Nazis came, and phase number two, and after that, all these things together just composed the run-up to the war, which is what it did.
The two of the most toxic aspects of Nazism were eugenics and, of course, economic fascism. And these were popular ideas on Wall Street at the time, were they not?
Yeah, eugenics. Was it Francis Galton? They had it in the '20s in the United States. And I don't know exactly whether he was. I doubt that he was influenced by them, but I certainly know that there were contacts, fairly close contact between these eugenists and these theorists of the race in the '20s that were eventually very close to the Nazis, that would travel to these societies in the English-speaking world that were for the sterilization of the unfit. And so, yes, these beliefs in racial differences, they were also rife in the Anglo-Saxon culture.
I believe.
But I think that the Nazis, their own, this particular view, came from much more ancient and occult roots that have to do with particular esoteric conceptions of the world in which they're very much alive in the upper echelons of the SS, which were a knighthood, in fact, and who believed, they believed. I mean, this might not make sense to a positive outlook of the world or to the way in which we think, but certainly they believed that there was these races in this world, each represented by its own spirit guide, vying for some kind of a spiritual supremacy, and they believe that some kind of salvific development could be attained if the German race were purged of this alien presence, which was the Jewish one. But these things, they were not fantasies or simple scapegoating devices. They were part of a very deeply held belief at the very upper part of the Nazi establishment, which was kept behind closed doors, and of course, which was vulgarized in all sorts of conspiratorial ways for the masses. But
did you run
that's an aspect that is central, and Hitler himself said it. I mean, we are a religious organization fronted by a political apparatus. Exactly what it was, and very few scholars have gone into looking into this. Aspect.
Did you find
which I think is absolutely essential.
Yeah. Did you find any correlation with occult beliefs in the Western political establishments?
And the Nazis?
Between the Nazis and, say, the Anglo-American Empire? I mean, were they...
There are all sorts. I've been reading a lot in this world, but I have not come yet to any kind of solid conclusions. But they say... I'm not sure, but they say yes. They mentioned lodges where similar thoughts were being, similar rituals and beliefs were being held, as they were in the Thule and these other groups in which the Nazis bred.
Yeah, but you've heard of
lodges such as the Golden Dawn, things like this. I always cited.
You've heard of
these things are. If you're an initiate, you can talk about these things. But if you're outside of these lodges, those are things that better be left alone, unless you really know what you're talking about.
You've heard about the Bohemian Grove in California?
Remind me.
Well, they allegedly have a yearly get-together. Very rich and powerful people come there, maybe a couple hundred people from around the world. And they hold these weird ceremonies involving mock sacrifices.
No.
You need to Google that.
No, I've not heard. But in this sense, the Holocaust is precisely what it was. I mean, I've read these theories expressed by...